World's Edge. What is the fourth common denominator of a winner in life? We said earlier that life is a game of choice or not chance, that losers let it happen and winners make it happen, that life is a do it with God for others to myself project. And I looked in the mirror and saw my biggest problem. It was me. I look in the mirror and I say, how would I like to be married to me? How would I like a father like me if I were my children? How would I like a boss like me, an employee like me? How would I like me as a best friend, a customer, or a vendor? In other words, life is not a game of chance. It's a game of choice. And the greatest thing about being free is your choice. I was the rehabilitation coordinator for our Vietnam prisoners of war. And when they came back and were released, they said the greatest thing that they missed when they kissed the ground when they got back was their freedom of choice. In this abundant country of ours and in the free societies around the world, we can choose our destiny. Winners determine their futures, usually in advance, but they project into the future what they want to occur, and they're accountable for the outcome of their success. I call that, in my mind, the Statue of Responsibility. You know, the Statue of Liberty is a really marvelous statue. She's the lady in the harbor. And if you've ever been to Battery Park or there in New York, standing there majestically, Battery Park, Ellis Island, the lady in the harbor. You remember the French gave her to us? You remember why the French gave us the Statue of Liberty? They gave us the Statue of Liberty because we had a democracy. Because the Statue of Liberty reminded them that here's a country where immigrants come from all over the world, from every ethnic, religious, every kind of culture, and they come into this land, and she holds a torch. She's got a torch in one hand, and she's got a tablet in the other. She has chains at her feet. And she says, give me your tired and hungry. Give me your immigrants, and let them come into this land and choose to be free, free to win, free to choose, free to lose. In other words, you take the potential you were born with, and you live up to it by the choices you make. If life is a game of cards, only you determine how you play your hand. And that's why it doesn't matter what hand you are dealt. It's the way you play your hand that counts. It's cause and effect. You do things, and things happen. There's a logical consequence and a logical reward for everything you do. Getting back to the Statue of Liberty, I believe that there should be another statue in the other harbor in San Francisco. That would be the perfect place for her. And she could be given to us maybe by China or Japan or one of the Asian countries. Maybe India would give her to us. And she would stand there majestically looking very much like the Statue of Liberty, but with the forgotten side of freedom. Because when you choose to do something, something happens with every choice that you make. You have to live with it. And there she would stand. I want you to picture her, the Statue of Responsibility. She has an eagle in one hand, symbolizing our desire to fly free, free to be anything we want to be, free to dress like we want, say what we want, watch what we want, do anything we want. That's what America always wants, is freedom. That's the eagle instead of the torch. In the other hand is a baby, symbolizing our responsibility to the next generation. If you want to fly free, be careful, because what you choose impacts people other than yourself, the next generation. And where would we put this Statue of Responsibility? We would put her, of course, on Alcatraz. Why? Well, Alcatraz, unlike Ellis Island, now remember, Ellis Island is where the immigrants came in to get their passport to freedom. But Alcatraz is where you get it taken away because of the effects of your choices. If you live irresponsibly, you end up in prison. If you live responsibly, you remain free. The statue of responsibility would be on Alcatraz, and I picture her in the year 2020. My great-grandchildren are coming from Stanford University, which is now Asian Studies. And you've got the Sumitomo Bank, and you've got the Orient and the Mandarin Hotels in San Francisco. You've got the tremendous rise of China and the Asian nations. And I hope one day there will not be a statue of responsibility on Alcatraz with an inscription on the bottom. For every choice that you make, you have to live with the consequence. For every freedom that you want, there's a responsibility which you should take. For every gift that you get, there's also a service you must render. For your choices in life will always cause the effects. I hope the statue of responsibility will always become a virtual responsibility statue. And I hope that we can have essays in junior high and high schools to show that freedom isn't free at all. It carries with it a responsible choice. You know, my friend and fellow colleague, Stephen Covey, in his book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, called responsibility the combination of two words, response and ability. Your ability to respond effectively to anything that's thrown at you, because stuff happens. So it's really not what happens to you that counts. It's how you take it and what you make of it. And it's your choice. I call that idea the seven C's. The seven C's of control. So what do you control in life? Well, you control the clock. No, yes, you do. I know it runs. And the clock always laughs at you. But remember, the clock and how you use the clock is in your control. Time is the only equal opportunity employer. We each have 168 hours per week on a chessboard. We don't move time. We don't save time. We can kill time. We can waste it. But we can't save it for another day. You control your use of time. It's the energy of life. When you make money and lose it, you can get it back. When you spend time, you can't get it back. You may remember Queen Elizabeth I of England on her deathbed, the most powerful woman in the world, who whispered to her doctor, "My entire kingdom for another moment of life." You'd never trade hours for dollars in life. And you can't possibly trade hours for dollars and get there. You must move priorities in time. You see, we don't have a time management problem in life. We have a priority management. And we tend to do things that are tension relieving instead of goal achieving. Take a look at the way you use the clock and get up a little earlier in the morning. And as you wake up, decide what you're going to do with this day that will get you and those close to you closer to the goals you've set. Don't fill up your calendar with other people's goals. Don't just be activity-oriented, be priority-oriented. And understand perhaps the greatest control of time that you have, maybe not during the day when you're working for money, when you're employed by someone else, when you're told what to do and when to get there and when to leave, but you control your free time. And the best control or responsibility you have with the clock is during prime time. And prime time is 6 to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, all during the week. And this is why I beg you to continue to watch this kind of programming. Why should you watch this kind of programming? Because most people spend their lives watching other people making money, having fun in their profession. They watch people doing what they love for their profession, actors, actresses, sports heroes, people, comedians who are stand-up comics, doing what they love and being paid well for it. And we watch, after a frustrating day, other people making money, having fun. They don't call it prime time for nothing. That's when everyone's watching in America. So instead of watching escape, unreality television, watch the real thing that will help you become better and use prime time, 6 to 11 p.m., to network, to write, to email, to be intimate with your family, to be eating together, to be talking together, to be listening together, to be working together, and to be reading while other people are watching. Controlling the clock is one of the greatest things you can do in your life, because you don't realize until it's too late that you've been wasting that marvelous time that can never be saved. So live in prime time instead of watching in prime time. And as an aside, I might tell you, every book I've written, all 15, have been written during the week, in the evenings, instead of watching television. I was able to do something for my life that I wanted instead of watching other people live their dreams. That's why you need to control the first of the seven C's, the clock. The second of the seven C's is controlling your concepts. And what are concepts? Well, we talked about dream and passion. Your concept is your imaginary idea of what the future is. And the winners who have the edge that I know can conceptualize the future in concrete enough terms so the concepts they have are usually imagination that is inspiration. Instead of looking at the things they don't want and talking about the things they don't want, instead of counting their blemishes, instead of their blessings, your concept should be of the kind of life you want, the kind of person you want to be, the kind of family you want to represent, the kind of lifestyle you want when you don't need to work anymore. What kind of life are you designing for the future? Because you are indeed designing your future every day. The concepts you have, the imaginations, can be enriched by reading, watching Discovery, watching National Geographic, watching history, watching shows that show you how to do things, going out to job fairs and computer fairs, going out places and watching other people doing things, so you realize that instead of escape television, you're watching inspiration television. And the concepts that you have, therefore, will be able to be shaped into what I call the third of the seven C's, your causes. A cause is a concept given definition. A cause is a specific goal. It is a guided missile. It is a, if you will, a homing torpedo. I love the way Maxwell Maltz, many years ago, wrote one of the best-selling books that's ever been written on self-help, Psycho-Cybernetics. What does that mean? Psycho, the mind, and cyber, the steersman. Cybernetics, the automatic steering toward your goal in your mind. Winners control their causes. They use the clock to develop concepts that become causes that they will allow little distraction away from that definition. And the reason leaders are followed is because leaders have a clearer vision of where they want to go, of the future that they see. They shape the concepts into an outcome that everyone can visualize and therefore wants to follow. So make sure that you have goals that are set. And what I love to do with my family, which I do every year, instead of going out at midnight, counting down, watching the ball come down in Times Square, I do that. But what I do at that moment is I surround myself with my loved ones. I open up the envelope that each of us has made the New Year's Eve before. And on New Year's Eve every year, my loved ones and I open the envelope to see how close we came to the personal and professional goals or causes that we set the New Year's Eve before. That's why winter is such a great time to plan. That's why the spring is a great time to plant. That's why the summer is a great time to be active and to cultivate. And that's why the autumn of any goal is a great time to harvest. Control your causes, and you will definitely make your dreams a reality. The fourth of the seven C's is to control your conversations. In other words, control your communications. The winner's edge is being able to listen, ask questions, You know, I don't learn anything when I talk like this. I learn nothing. I only learn when I ask questions and I learn from you. And so the conversations that you have with your children, with your employee mates, your teammates, your friends, should be questions. If you must speak, ask a question. How are you doing? What's going on in your life? If it weren't for time, money, and circumstance, what would you do? If time were no consideration, you had the money, and if circumstances allowed, what would you do? And then you listen. And you ask more questions and you listen. And the more you listen to someone else, the more you find out their hot button, what turns them on in life. And by finding out what people want, you've just gotten your way to close any sale or to be important to anyone else. Because they know for sure that when you ask them about their lives and show true interest, that you're really a winner and a coach on their side. The conversations that you have not only are with yourself, but they're with other people. So what I do in my life is I always ask myself, what's the answer? What's the solutions? And I talk in terms of I want to, I can, next time it'll be better. And I never say I have to or I can't. I never talk in terms of negatives because I know this conversation I have is having an impact on me and on them. Understand what you've got inside your mind. You have Are You Me Too from Star Wars, not R2-D2, but Are You Me Too. I have a little robot that goes around with me. I tell it what I'm thinking. I tell it what I see. I tell my little robot all my hopes and fears. It listens and remembers everything it hears. At first, my little robot, excuse me, at first, my little robot followed my command. But after many years of training, mine's gotten out of hand. It doesn't care what's right or wrong or what is false or true. No matter what I try now, it tells me what to do. The most important opinion you'll ever have is the one you have of yourself. And the most important conversation you'll ever control is the conversation you have with you and then the way you explain yourself to other people. The fifth of the great seven C's is controlling your contacts. You control your friends. You control the people that you run with. You control the people that you have lunch with. You control those people in your life who are role models and mentors and friends. Make sure that you play golf with people a little better than you. Make sure that you're dealing with people who've achieved a little more than you, and they will keep you in dynamic tension, not frustration, but positive tension. I've always learned from people who are doing better than me, and that's why I never want to feel superior to the people I'm with. I want to know that from each of them I can learn. That's why it's so important to control the contacts, because you shall know people by the people you spend time with. You know yourself by the time spent. The sixth is to control your concerns. And you control the way you respond to people by saying to yourself, okay, I don't have control over what they just said or did, but I do have control over the way I respond to what they're doing. And that's why, in my mind, I always say, accept the unchangeable, that which has happened. Change the changeable, the way you respond to what people do and say, and remove yourself from things that are not tolerable to you. You control your concerns and the way you respond to people. And number seven, you control your commitments. A commitment is the amount of clock, the amount of time you give the conceptual ideas that become causes that you communicate. You control your commitments in time. You may not think you do, but you alone control the commitments that you make. And those are the seven C's. It's really funny, you know, I was a jet pilot for the Navy, and I was macho. And what I used to do is I used to wear my flight suit to mow the lawn. I used to wear my helmet in the car, driving a Porsche Targa, looking for Honda Civics to intimidate. I had two leather bullet belts with armor-piercing slugs, a .45 on my side, and a Crocodile Dundee knife stuffed in my flight boot. And I used to love to chase farmers on their tractors. One of the greatest thrills you have as a young Navy pilot is four of you to go to the valley, watch a farmer plowing beans. You know he's bored. You know he wants excitement, so you give him his own air show. And you come in just above his tractor, and he's got an umbrella. And you come in supersonic so he can't hear you. He has to experience you when you arrive. And what you do is you do a fleur-de-lis, and you hit the afterburner. And it nearly raises the tractor off the ground, and the farmer leaps off into the irrigation ditch. And a farmer is the only person that I know that can leap off his tractor into the irrigation ditch and memorize your tail number going by and then report it back to the authorities. Well, you can just imagine that me, as a macho pilot, comes home to my family, and what do I see? I see my daughter, 11 months old, in her high chair, strapped there, with my wife trying to feed her Gerber's strained squash, and she won't eat it. What does she know? She's 11 months old. She does what we tell her. I'm the boss of this family, and she has no choice. I grab the spoon out of my wife's hand because my wife has Gerber's strained squash in her hair, squash on her apron, squash on the tray, and none in the kid. I grabbed the spoon and said, "Let me show you how to do it." I put my helmet on. I looked at my daughter and said, "Open up, management." She blinked, but her gums clamped shut in defiance. I said, "Well, you're like your father, a mind of your own, huh?" And then I did what many parents do. I ate 3/4 of the jar of squash myself. Played airplane in the hangar, airplane in the hangar. Daddy loves the squash. I'm your role model. You watch me and you do what I do, right? We'll be out of here. Her gums clamped shut, the pupils in her eyeballs pinpointed, and I could tell what she was thinking, although she could not talk. She was saying, "Okay, fatso, you like it, you eat it." Well, my wife left the room, and I did what no parent should ever do, especially today, because I'd be arrested today, but I did something that you won't like. I pushed her cheeks together. I mean, there wasn't anyone there except me and God, and he was letting me make a fool out of myself. But I didn't do it hard. I just pushed her cheeks together a little bit, and her mouth came open. And I said, "You want some squash?" And I said, "Yeah." And I stuffed her mouth full of Gerber's strained squash and just carefully, gently held it shut like all good managers would do. And she wouldn't swallow. In fact, she held her breath. I couldn't believe it as her face was turning red and purple. Rather than swallow, I blurted out something really stupid. "Go ahead and die. You're not the only child. I've got other children. Before you die, you'll swallow. Come on." And I got close. And as I got close, she began to make rapid decisions. Angle, range, distance. I felt the linear acceleration through the nozzle as she began to exhale suddenly, causing Mount St. Helen to erupt in my nostrils. With a big target, I made a fatal Southern California yuppie error. Into my nasal pituitary area, I went and snorted squash. I stopped breathing and fell convulsing on the floor and tripped on her high chair. Fortunately, I had my helmet on. My wife came back in and said, "What happened, Top Gun?" I said, "Nothing. She doesn't like squash. Don't make a big deal about it." Now she's older and came by for Easter dinner not too long ago. She's grown and flown. I said, "Grandma bought some squash with marshmallow and pineapple in it to kill the taste." My daughter said, "I've never cared for squash. I've always wondered why." I said, "Well, you wonder, of course. There's a squash gene or maybe El Nino. Why don't I like squash, Dad? It's a time for truth." I said, "Well, your mother tried to force feed you when you were little." She said, "It was you, Dad. It was you." And one thing I've learned is that children take over shortly after birth and begin to make choices based upon testing, sampling, mommy against daddy. If whining gets goodies, the whining continues. Behavior always moves in the direction to the attention that's paid for it. And that's why it's so important to be accountable for the outcome in your life. I think back to my professor at United States International University, Viktor Frankl. All authors normally talk about him and his book, Man's Search for Meaning. He found out during the Holocaust that those individuals who were accountable for a purpose to be alive lived longer than those who didn't, of course. But more importantly than that, if you took your last piece of bread and ate it, you would not live as long as if you broke it in half, gave part to someone else, and ate the other part. Why? You were accountable for the outcome of a purpose greater than yourself. I think we're either thermometers or thermostats. A thermometer just lies there and reflects the external environment, externally motivated. But a thermostat is set on the side, and what you get is what you set. And you set it high and the heat comes on. And you set it low and the air conditioner comes on. You and I are thermostats. We have an inner setting inside of our mind that gets us just about where we're taking control of life. A thermometer reflects. A thermostat sets. Well, there's another story that I like to talk about, and it's Bradford the Barbarian. There was a little kid, 5 years old, and his parents gave him everything. They let him eat in the living room. He was still in a high chair at 5 years old, and he got out of his high chair. He poured all the food on the floor so it went through the shag pile carpet, and his parents said, "Don't, honey, we're trying to raise him into a little stallion and giving him what he needs." He tried to kick me in the shins, but I reflexed, and he missed and said I hit him, but I said I'd never hit the head of a household because it was a child-driven household, and I watched in amazement in America as they put cookies on the stairs and he ate his way to bed because they were letting Bradford run the household. I said, "How are you going to get him to go to school?" They said, "Well, we'll think of something." I said, "What if the dogs eat it?" And they didn't invite me to stay for dessert. They simply said, "I guess he is in control right now." Autogenic training, mental training. My breathing is relaxed and effortless. My brain helps my breathing relax. My heartbeat is slow and regular. I control my heartbeat and bring it down. The brain has the amazing capacity to control even body functions autogenically. And as we've trained Olympic athletes through the years, I have to go back to the most incredible story I've ever witnessed in 1980 as chairman of psychology for the Olympics. It's called, of course, the Miracle on Ice. A pickup team of young American skaters, not one may be destined for the NHL. And you get a coach like Herb Brooks, who said to those young men against the Russians who had beat them soundly only 2 weeks before in Madison Square Garden, "I don't want your life. I just want 70 minutes of your time. And I want you to know that you're young and you're fast and they're overconfident and they're all military or professionals, but you are young and quick and will take it to them and you will score. And in those 70 minutes that you'll give me, you will win the gold medal in the 1980 Olympics in ice hockey." And we watched. He expected. He gave them permission. They took responsibility. They were accountable. And the miracle on ice unfolded as we knew it would. Winners make it happen. Losers let it happen. Life is not a game of chance. Life is a game of choice. When you make a choice, make it the winning choice because you'll live with it, because the mind always moves toward your currently dominant thought. The winner's edge is that winners also determine the future in advance.